You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Em Walker. In this episode, we're going to look at human factors and crisis management with Matt Edwards. So what to do is really examine the fundamentals of human factors around the individual perspective and look at some seminal cases that Matt's experienced in practice, and also look at the concept of routine versus crisis management and how checklists work and maybe indeed even interact with within crisis management. So we're also going to look at how humans interact within healthcare and change outcomes for the better. We're also going to look at the concept of civility versus risk aversion, and also the concept of trust. We're also going to examine Matt's mitigation strategies around the individual and how the individual interacts with their environments, and indeed can it affect the environment from a detection and response to hazards and from a perception perspective. We're also going to look at mitigation of distraction, how to avoid decision-making paralysis, the limitations of memory. We're also going to look at the regular attenders of stress and fatigue within pre-hospital care, and finally, the effects of communication on individual task and team. So to do this, I have Matt Edwards with me. Matt is a consultant, adult and paediatric emergency medicine doctor at King's College Hospital, London. He's also the lead for major trauma and education. He's also worked as a HEMS physician with Kent Surrey Sussex Air Ambulance and indeed the Polar Medicine Course Director for World Extreme Medicine. He has held positions in the past at London HEMS, so a HEMS registrar within London's Air Ambulance, and indeed a flight physician at AMREF Flying Doctors Nairobi. If that wasn't enough, he's also been a medical officer with the British Antarctic Survey. Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Hello, hello.
Matt, I just wondered if, firstly, if we could just get you to speak to human factors and maybe sort of what it means to you as a clinician.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are like proper definitions of what this is. But for me, I think what human factors means is that extra layer on top of the systems that we work in, which are, you know, which have that, you know, unique human quality to them. It's those elements within the process that are odd, challenging, but, you know, I guess uniquely beautiful because they are human, and occasionally predictable, occasionally not, and complex. And it's that layer of system complexity, and I do like sort of love the study of it because it often confounds the conventional rational way in which people expect or have designed things to work, and us humans seem to keep confounding it. I mean, and that can go from quite quite individual relationship types of cognitive stuff all the way up to, you know, macroeconomics and things, you know, like the, so you've seen the burgeoning popularity of things like behavioral economics. Well, that's in my mind, that's human factors on a massive scale, all the way down to, you know, the type one, type two thinking that is, has become incredibly important, which obviously is the underlying sort of factors behind behavioral economics, but it's there within the human factors we work in. And then you expand it out to these strange, complex adaptive systems that we have in hospitals. We've got all these different people all interacting. You've got all these sort of emotional factors and things like that that sort of come into it. And none of these things are sort of generally planned for or sort of, you know, considered within the system processes and how things are supposed to work. I mean, like, so for example, you know, in medicine, it's almost like we get sort of trained with these, I'm not going to call them lies because that's unfair, but these assumptions about how structured we are in our thinking, that we are rational decision makers, and that we're scientists, and that everyone's sort of playing with the same team, but then all we find all the time is that there's variation in healthcare. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, because it's a patient-doctor relationship. You see these differences in performance in different types of teams, and there's absolutely nothing to as far as you can see on paper between one team and the other, and that's what human factors means to me. It's this extra layer on top of the processes that we have designed that are there and often not given enough enough importance because we are human and our brain works in an incredibly unique and sophisticated way.
I think what you're speaking to there, Matt, is how the other part, and this is purely human factors from a system basis, how do systems interlock? How do they work irrespective of how the intra-team dynamics are working? And I really like that. And I and you probably see that on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen how a disregard for human factors has meant various different organizations have failed to have created massive errors and massive failures because there has been this real reluctance to accept that human factors are a thing, that essentially they're not seen as human factors, they're seen as human failures. And you know, even from something as famous as the Chernobyl disaster, you know, you've got people being put through systems whereby they're set up to fail, but not because they're, you know, because of the incentives and the motivations within this system, as opposed to the system actually being all that bad. It's just that the way the humans are sort of treated and you know, within that system, it all sort of falls apart. Because one of the things I love about this work is how blind we are to it often, is how unwilling we are, certainly as doctors and scientists and even pilots or whatever, how we don't like to accept the fact that our brains work in these relatively, well, sometimes predictable or unpredictable ways, and they can be responsible for the success or failure of the task that's been put in front of us, when all these different sort of interlocking, you know, circumstances create the problem in front of us. And then you add in our psychology, our emotional state, our ability to be able to, you know, bring in system one, system two thinking, and our relationships with other human beings who are doing exactly the same thing, and you get this vast complexity. And so it's often just that the reluctance to sort of see the human factors within how our systems work, which is this extra really sort of interesting, frustrating, but often, you know, very, very interesting element to it, because it still comes up again and again that you have to try to explain within a safety culture and with all these other kind of things, is how to mitigate the human factors. And if you don't accept the human factors kind of exist and it's just human failures, then you never get a safety culture. And like, and on extra, even extra level to that, is that even when you get people who have understood it, even then when you get people who have sort of drunk the Kool-Aid, as it were, of human factors, they're still very reluctant to see it in themselves. And I'm as guilty as that, as the next person. Like to be able to go back and reflect and see, that's how this worked. And I fell into that trap, which I've actually probably given a presentation on. You know, it's like it's still that predictable. Even if you say, like, have studied it and know all about it, you're still subject to these failures and flaws. As I said, and there you are. I'm calling them human failures as well. But what I'm saying, you know, is that you can study it as much as you like, but because you are human, you're never gonna get rid of them.
So let's contextualize that, because I think that's a fantastic insight. I think it's that you daily sign up to acknowledgement of human factors, because like you said, you get out of bed and you may or may not have slept well. You may or may not actually want to be at work that day. You will have multiple issues in home life, in public life, whatever, but there's no free pass. There's always impending issues which you're going to have to mitigate, or indeed at least acknowledge, before you show up to work every day, and no one gets a free ride of that. So maybe from a contextual perspective, because you have spoken to in the past, Matt, you know, a few seminal moments that you've learned a lot from individual and or system human factors, could you maybe speak to one of the cases that you learned a lot from? Because I think I learned a lot from listening to you in some of these cases in the past, and it might just be an appropriate frame of reference to really contextualize your last answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think before I do though, I think that I kicked myself at the end of what I was saying then, because I obviously contradicted myself, saying that human factors are seen as being human failures. But actually, there is a lot to be said for what we as humans bring to the table in these complex problem solving and system based things. But unfortunately, we often sort of highlight where they bring about error. And so it's often seen as being very, very negative. But there's also this incredible ability that we have to synthesize and decide almost sort of subconsciously and do stuff because it feels like the right thing. And then retrospectively, you recognize maybe that's what it was, and someone's body language or sort of these cues from human interactions to put you on the right path. Sometimes it's like we enter into these system based thinking, and we look at the human factors element of it, and it is often portrayed in quite a negative way, and in some ways that's at least that is a step forward in accepting that it is a, you know, these human factors are a way in which our expectations can be founded, but I think there's a lot to be said for what, I think we're on a brink at the moment in which we are sitting and looking at technology like ChatGPT and AI and all these other kind of things, and thinking that, okay, well, they will in time remove the human factors from what we do. And I think that, you know, our discussions about human factors possibly do need to be framed in that there are pros and cons to how we do things. And so when I bring up this first case, whilst it is definitely, you know, I learned a huge amount about my own thought processes and how my own problem solving and that kind of stuff can be confounded by by emotion and fear and that kind of stuff. You come out the back of that, and when you identify that and you put the right training in place, you realize that human factors also are part of things like crew resource management and how to get the best out of a team and how to get a team to operate in a state of flow and get loads of processes to be working in parallel to each other rather than in series. And you can get an incredible team to work alongside each other, which, you know, I'm not convinced necessarily that anything that we create is going to be able to do quite as well as humans when they're working at their top training.
Well, you make a really good point actually there, Mike, just before you do come in on the case you were going to mention, because I think, like you said, what doesn't get highlighted in practice is when things are working well, and actually when human factors are mitigated or at least acknowledged, and the team has worked the solution, albeit to the system or as a system workaround. But that actually, when good use of checklists, these things may get acknowledged in case review or D&D, but actually they quite frequently are not mentioned. And so actually, to your point, the case you're just about to tell is when maybe things didn't go so well, and indeed when they went wrong. But actually, what we have to acknowledge is that people are mitigating human factors on a daily basis. Teams are mitigating them through use of things like checklists, through use of things like acknowledgement, escalation techniques, circuit breaking techniques to break someone out of their biases. But they don't necessarily get airtime, because things have gone right. And actually, again, it's hard to learn from when things have gone right, but it's nonetheless still good to call out good practice and see. I think you could probably speak to this. I've certainly been in the room or the car or the helicopter when I have seen someone really steward some really good CRM and mitigate some really, really what could have been horrendous human factors. And I've seen them steward it well. And it's not even sometimes verbal, sometimes it's nonverbal, or sometimes it's just the way they hold themselves and know when to come in and when to move back. And actually, you learn more from that scene, but it's hard to capture it, and it's also hard to maybe highlight that in front of other people. So to your point, I think, you know, when it goes wrong, it gets quite rightly so shouted out from the rooftops, because it is a learning opportunity. But actually, it's good to call out good practice, and it's good to call out when human factors are acknowledged and mitigated as well.
Yeah. So this case, I think the reason I keep coming back to this case is because it was the first time I really reflected deeply about my brain and about how it had been sort of circumvented, and how, you know, perceptual problems had come into the fore, and this kind of it started a journey, I guess, for me. In my practice, and a deep fascination. I mean, so like, as I said to you earlier, you know, you could have, I'm sure, found some real experts in human factors to come and speak, and probably think you're regressing not doing that right now. But for me, it really did start this journey for me being a very, very interested amateur, and has informed a huge amount of my practice and my education, my simulation work, and all these kinds of things. And I think hopefully by the time I sort of finished my mad ramblings, people would have got a little bit of a sense of how that journey can help them and how they can help sort of think about it. Because I think that a lot of people who are involved in pre-hospital medicine, expedition medicine, etc., they are generally speaking relatively early on in their clinical lives, and they are just about to start to get quite clinically independent and by the very nature of this kind of work, clinically isolated. And so having a good understanding of this kind of stuff, I think, is really important before you venture out into these kind of environments when you are quite clinically isolated and very responsible for these clinical decisions. So, so I had started my medical career in 2008. I graduated Bristol University, did a load of different jobs, and was sort of at the point at which these days you would have been starting your sort of surgical registrar training. And I left that and went to take a job with the British Antarctic Survey, did a few other jobs after that. But so basically was a sort of early EM registrar, and had done anaesthetics for quite a bit, because I thought actually I was going to go into anaesthetics to begin with, or critical care. And that didn't work out. So I was one of these sort of relatively familiar nomads of medicine, and ended up in a job working for a retrieval team out of East Africa in Nairobi. And I was working with a critical care nurse, and we went to go and pick up a chap in Ethiopia. And the whole process of this little retrieval team at that time was that you would go out to clinics or other small hospitals, and you'd be bringing a patient either back to Nairobi or repatriating them and things. So a lot of standard air ambulance work for anyone who works in critical care and does retrieval, that kind of stuff. But there was also quite a lot of primary work, because the places you're picking people up from may not actually have ambulance services, may not actually have anything beyond sort of just clinic in the middle of nowhere. So it was a very varied job, and I do recommend people if they're interested to go and have a look at their website and have a look at the volunteer physician program. It's a long time ago I did this. It was 2013. Anyway, so we're there and we've gone out to see this guy and pick him up. He supposedly had cerebral malaria and was quite sick, and he was getting worse, but he'd had a seizure, but he'd come round, and he was his GCS was high enough for him to be able to maintain his airway and had a bit of suctioning every now and again. He possibly had an infarct on top. But so he was in a pretty bad way with all this. And so we made the decision we were going to intubate this gentleman as the safest thing to be able to retrieve in such a large distance in the back of an aircraft. And to cut a long story short, essentially I identified relatively late into our intubation process that he was actually going to be quite a challenging airway, big incisors, long neck, and I also had equipment failure at the same time with it's a thing that I look out for now, but at the time didn't even realize was a possibility. It was those old sort of screw-on bulbs, and with this particular laryngoscope, if you opened it and the light came on, you put pressure through it and the light went off. And so gave it back to the critical care nurse who I was with. She opened it and did exactly what I didn't want and gave it straight back to me and said, look, it works fine. And so at this time, this gentleman is also quite sick for some pulmonary complications, is dropping his saturations. And so we start going around a bit of a dark hole, and that he actually was, we were actually able to ventilate him. But I was sort of, we had the equipment, the standard equipment out for an intubation, but we didn't have, we weren't using a bougie. That was kind of our get out of jail thing, and a laryngeal mask airway was not available as quickly as it should have been, and all these other kind of things, which I now would do very, very differently. I think the thing that I was left with was this sudden realization that it's out. Was going to die. I think that most people cognitively understand that that's the risk that you are taking when you paralyze a patient and intubate them. And I can hear almost in the back of my mind the huge number of anesthetic colleagues who are listening to going, yeah, that's what emergency physicians are like. And in some ways I sympathize with that, and in other ways I don't, because as I said, I have now subsequently worked in systems which have got excellent track records for being able to have fantastic success with laryngoscopy because the system is different. Now, I'm not saying that with more laryngoscopy experience and so on and so forth, that situation would have gone better. I think it probably would have done. How the result of that actually, I mean, we did actually manage to intubate that guy, but did sort him out, and we did get him to Nairobi. But it was sketchy. It wasn't great. There was desaturation, there was hypotension, all these other kind of things, and it was by the skin of my teeth. But the lesson is not in that. The lesson was in that the fear that suddenly took over me, and the sort of respect for what the hell I was doing, and also the sort of hubris that actually I think a lot of practitioners might go into clinically isolated environments and go and do this kind of work, is something I'll never forget. Looking down that deep dark hole and suddenly realizing this is really going very badly wrong. I've subsequently seen the result of a senior clinician have an airway death under their care, and it's been utterly, utterly devastating. And I think that sort of that level of terror is quite reasonable. It actually happened to be the lead for CRM from the air ambulance team, and he said it was in a way it was fascinating because he was watching with the co-pilot, and he said it was like watching two pilots with engine failure, and he said that all the stuff that we teach around CRM was there, all the stuff. And he said, if you like, I'll take you through some of it, and he did. And I learned so much, and I started Googling it, and I started, you know, and I found the stuff from London's Air Ambulance surrounding checklists, surrounding training and all this other kind of stuff. So from there, I mean, it was a long process, but from there we started doing more stuff with checklists at MRF Flying Doctors. We started doing more drills and training. I think that there was a cultural shift there, because prior to what we were doing, there was very much this, you know, and it's not unfamiliar to many parts of the world, this sort of hierarchy of doctor say, nurse do, and there was always this kind of expectation that the doctor would sort of turn up on the flight and the nurse would know where all the kit was. And part of our problem that night had been that I just didn't know where anything was, and the nurse did, but we just weren't communicating well enough. We weren't communicating what we needed well enough, or I wasn't anyway. So when I came away, I sort of reflected on it and looked at, like, okay, well, what proportion of that set of errors was like a degree of inexperience, fair enough. The environmental challenges of location and light and blah, 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 how much of it was equipment failure, how much of it was communication, and how much of it was team training and that kind of stuff. And it wasn't, and looking at it, you know, and being very honest and sort of going through it with these pilots, it was a real hodgepodge of various different things that were creating this error. And so from that experience, we changed some of the training stuff that we did at the Air Ambulance. We've got some really great nurse champions there who are like, yeah, we've identified this as being an issue potentially with other doctors who have come through, because we just don't necessarily work along the same lines, and we want to make it an AMREF way of doing things. And then I went for a job with London's Air Ambulance. I told them about what we'd been doing and how I'd basically stolen their stuff, and got a job with them. And then I was able to put that same stuff into practice with them. And God, don't get me wrong, it's not as if when I went to work for London's Air Ambulance, any of these particular issues have been solved for me. God, no. I had a particularly challenging sign-off period. I think it took me sort of, most doctors are signed off in a month. I think it took me two. So, you know, it certainly wasn't smooth sailing. And there's nothing quite like, I think, the sign-off period for, I think, the vast majority of the pre-hospital services, but London's Air Ambulance is certainly one of the most rigorous in the world, I think. And it's nothing quite like that to really make you challenge your own assumptions about your own qualities as a clinician. And so, learned a huge amount. And that's sort of, that was the journey for me. That's sort of how I started. The reason that case is so, you know, so interesting to me is that I think it did start off that journey for my interest in human factors and how they affected me as a clinician. It obviously sparked a massive interest in pre-hospital medicine, and that led to me getting my job with London's Air Ambulance, I'm sure of it, and to having the insight and the ability to be able to pull myself through the sign-off process and so on to where I am now, I guess. And so you have these pivotal moments in your medical career, and I think that for me, that moment underneath that wing of an aircraft in Addis Ababa was one of those pivotal moments that led me to be where I am today, I think.
There's lots of information there, Matt, which is super interesting. And like you said, I think as you become, as you progress in your career, the amount that you reflect on practice hopefully increases, and there's a lot of kind of learning from that reflection there. And one of the things you did say, which I really acknowledge, is that It's easy to attribute mitigation to one factor like checklist, or if there'd been a checklist, we wouldn't have this, there wouldn't have been this, all this incremental stress. Whereas actually it's a lot of interlocking mitigation strategies, not just one. And to your point there around levels of experience, where you can call forward your previous experience, use of checklists, this good, clear lines of communication, having which happens in London's air ambulance a lot, which is a second blade with either the same laryngoscope or indeed a different size, but having checked that prior to, so you've got a fallback mechanisms, two is one and one is none, and you have that with suction units, and you have that with a number of devices, so that there is fallback. But you're right, it's all these interlocking principles coming together, so there's just not just one but there is many, and then through the process of those multiple mitigation factors, we get to, like you said, a baseline of safe practice. I'll compound that with closed loop communication, with shared mental models, with coming to the decision point, with asking have I missed anything, with name attribution, good eye contact, all these verbal and non-verbal principles coming into play as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, the temptation is to see human factors like equals checklists and not a lot else, which is also slightly odd, because that's definitely not all it is. I think the difference for me as well is that yes, you put in these mitigating safety structures, and that's that, and which are speaking to an acknowledgement of the human condition and these human factors which come into play, and to try to make it as safe as possible. And I'm going to touch on a couple of different concepts that underlie those things. But like the what you're aiming for with something like a pre-hospital code red, RSI, all guns blazing kind of challenging pre-hospital trauma case is that ability to be able to take a well-drilled team and get the best out of them, and get the, and means that that's when you start to get into your concepts and of bandwidth and being able to problem solve a challenging case at the absolute max of your cognitive ability, because all the other stuff is so routine, is so like that, that's cool. I had a case the other day from an airway perspective in which there was equipment issues, as well as a pretty challenging airway as well, just anatomically, with blood and all that kind of stuff. And looking back on it, there's no way. I mean, obviously this is one of those things that all the people who want to go in and say, well, how did you get that kind of experience without doing those things? Like, well, actually, there's a huge amount that you can do in terms of just drilling stuff and understanding what your problem solving your system will be before you even start it. There's loads of different training things you can do. And I think that you were probably going to ask me just about some of these things that we can do to try to mitigate these stuff. But the training is so vital. I'm a real, massive believer, believer in that. And as I said, it's that ability to be able to, on top of all the stuff that normally would be quite hard, to suddenly go up an extra step and be able to problem solve on top of that, because you've drilled it, you've already been there, even if not actually, but sort of in your mind, you've been there. And that's, that's that principle that that I think we have to work on a bit better in our in-hospital work.
So Matt, could you speak to the tension that clinicians feel between routine procedures and crisis management, and indeed why checklists work so well within crisis management?
Yeah, I think one of the issues we have, having tried to instigate checklists in various places, from pediatric critical care to my own emergency department to AMREF flying doctors, etc., is that I think there's a lot of mistrust of checklists, and some of it is actually very well founded. because we don't often apply checklists in the correct way, I don't think. I think the way to think about checklists is it's there to mitigate two cognitive states, two states of mind in which you've got different voices yelling at you. And okay, hear me out here. This is so basically, like, we've all got a kind of inner monologue going on, right? And anyone who is starting to get a bit worried about me and me hearing voices, like, okay, well, anyone who's tried to do any meditation, you'll understand that actually trying to get your thoughts to stop is actually really quite challenging. Because so we all have that. We all have this inner monologue going on. And essentially, you've got checklists which are there for routine but relatively sort of complex practice, in which you've got a whole load of stuff you need to remember, in which your inner monologue is very good at being able to distract you and have like a little chat with your inner little. And like, you've got such a small amount of stimulation, and it's supposedly routine. It's very easy for you to forget stuff. So as I said, the easy sort of thing to think about in that is your WHO sort of checklist, safety checklist around before you take a patient to theatre. How could people operate on the wrong leg? Well, it's because you're in that kind of routine state of awareness and whatever. How could people forget to do various different bits of the checklist before they take off in a plane? They've done it a million times before. It's exactly that. In my mind, that's how I think about it, is there's a little voice inside your head still jabbering away about what you're going to have for dinner, and you're sitting there with this. So essentially, you've got huge bandwidth, and you're using it on other stuff. That's what's going on there. And then you go to the other extreme, which is where a different type of checklist is required, when you're in the extreme of a situation, when you're in a crisis situation, and that voice is now screaming at you. That voice is screaming at you, and it's all you can hear. And so you're in these two different states. And the other checklist is a very different type of checklist. It's one that should only require a very small amount of your bandwidth, but it's enough to be able to trigger the thoughts for you to do the stuff in the right order and to do the right stuff. So it's the difference for us in our pre-hospital care practice of the routine checking of the bag and doing a routine checklist prior to intubating a patient, and something like 30 seconds drills. And you'll see that, you know, the pilots are very similar things. They have a checklist for before they take off every time, and they have their crisis cards for the various different situations. They still go through them. And so I think the problem is, and why people don't like checklists for things like a pre-intubation checklist, is that one of the reasons is because they're too slow, and that's often true. That is true when they're not being used in the correct way. So if you're using a checklist in order to be able to get all the various different bits ready, then yes, it will be too slow. It's a very inefficient way of practicing. So as in, if you're using the checklist to set up your equipment, you know, that just doesn't work. It should always be that final sort of process in which you can mitigate a couple of errors if they happen to be there, but it shouldn't be the way in which you actually get stuff ready. There has to be a degree of, let's, you know, that we've done this at quite, you know, a million times before. So let's do it like we've done it a million times before. And then you do the checklist at the end, because just in case you haven't done something right, it's not supposed to be there for that purpose. And that's where I think a lot of people get this wrong, is they seem to think that a checklist is there instead of training to be able to deliver a procedure. Okay. That's not what it's supposed to be. That's an instruction manual. Yeah, that's a different thing. It's not a checklist. And similarly speaking, if you're employing a full safety checklist in a crisis situation, you're also doing the wrong thing. So that's when you're using your absolute, you know, and when you're more sort of going down the lines of, of algorithms, your basic this then that kind of training, which has to be by its very nature very simple, only a few different things that are absolutely critical. Nothing that is not critical can possibly be in that, and has to be absolutely rigorous to those things. And you go through it again and again and again until you're out of your crisis. And so, as I said, you've got one situation where you've got your brain chattering away at you, like the complete random stuff, and you could easily get distracted and forget one of the things that you've routinely done a million times before. And the other situation where you're in crisis mode, but you need those cognitive triggers to be able to help you do those basic few things to make sure that it's done as safely as possible. But they are two different situations. And unfortunately, I think they get conflated. I think they all get attributed to the same thing. Like, so you say, like, oh, you know, you've got this patient crashing, he's got SATs of 60, or you're trying to, you know, and people think that, you know, a checklist, you know, a standard safety checklist is the answer. It's not. It, you know, you need a different type. And that, you know, and so I think that's part of it. These different types of checklists, and one of the things that is important to acknowledge when people are saying that, you know, it takes a long time, you know, it's slow and all that kind of stuff, is that, yeah, it does take time, because actually any process that is a safety process takes time. It's an additional thing on top of what you could do. Because let's say you've done everything correctly and you do a checklist that confirms you've done everything correctly. Well, you could say that checklist was a waste of time, right? Well, yeah, fair enough. It is in that particular instance, but that's clearly not why the checklist is there. And it actually comes down to a concept of instigating trust within systems. Trust is something that we talk about between people, and people understand that in terms of in relationships. But trust is something that's quite a useful concept in terms of all kinds of systems when humans are involved, because you can actually build in trust into systems, especially when you conceptualize it as having something called a trust tax. If you read the book The Speed of Trust, which is all about business, actually, it's not to do with, but you can get these kind of metaphors for how we practice in medicine, and basically the idea of it is, if there is trust, which is a sort of learned and evidence-based assumption on the behavior of others, if you have that trust, it increases speed and decreases cost. So if you instigate something that's a low trust policy, so a low trust policy would be by definition of a checklist, because we know we can't trust ourselves. We can't trust our own cognitive processes to be as safe as they should be for something that is so high risk. And so you instigate something called a trust tax, which is that acknowledgement that, because if you increase trust, you increase, you know, you're able to increase speed and decrease cost. Therefore, if you lower trust, you do the opposite. And so therefore, your things become slower, and it is, well, as a cost, whether that be equipment or whatever that happens to be. So for example, that would be the routine use of bougies, or you know, or the contingencies of using secondary suctions and all that other kind of stuff. So by having these redundancies, and by allowing things to go slower, you are saying that I don't trust you, in a way. I don't trust myself. I don't trust you. So it's almost, I almost see, like, if I stand at the end of the bed of this patient and I say to an anaesthetist, we're focusing quite a lot on intubation here, but I think it's just a very good microcosm of these things. And if I stand at the end of the bed and I say, we're going to do a checklist, and I get a role of the eyes, or even actually within an entire system. When I sort of suggested this kind of stuff to a team whereby, you know, where I was working in critical care a couple of years ago, who didn't have anything like this, but some of the consultants were interested, other consultants weren't, that it was almost like the base level of it, the base level of the objection was that I know what I'm doing, I don't need a checklist, you're almost insulting my professionalism, you're insulting my ability to be able to do this. And as I said, like right at the beginning, this impressive ability for human factors to have gone almost unrecognized, because we don't recognize it in ourselves, that could be an issue. And so like within that particular group of people who I was speaking to before about instigating a checklist, that it's still interesting that they have now got very used to it. And because a few of them have been bailed out by using a checklist, they're very much, you know, it's very on board, very much part of their culture now. However, at the beginning, it was like, oh yes, it sounds like a very useful thing as a training tool for juniors, but I don't need it. And that is fascinating. And so it for me, it's like another, you know, it's just like, what is it underneath it all that is causing this sort of distrust in checklists? One, I think that there is that misuse of it. But two, I think that this almost sort of psychology, sort of almost philosophical level about them is that the checklist is almost like this threat, almost like this insult of trust, of saying, you know, I don't trust you to do it correctly. Therefore, I'm going to sort of, you know, I'm gonna, you know, tick off this list and make sure you've done everything correctly. And it's almost professionally insulting. Do you see what I mean? I wonder whether there's that almost like psychological sort of thing at the back of people's minds that they don't even recognize is going on. But because it is, and it's by definition, a low trust policy.
I agree. And I think ego comes into play here, and it's a lot of subconscious ego actually as well. And I think one of the interlocking factors we are talking about here is that in pre-hospital care, you don't get to define the team on that day. So you'll be working with an unfamiliar paramedic. You might be working with an unfamiliar EMT, emergency medical technician, and or trainee paramedic that you may have never met before. So again, I think it's an ego move to think, you know, this skill is beholden to me, because actually often skills we rehearse and practice, like RSI, so like pre-hospital anesthesia, are a team sport. And actually the checklist is a cognitive circuit breaker. It breaks the reliance, but what it does also, it shows the wider team that we are prescriptive, and that there is an adherence to system. And what it does is it hopefully helps when there are outliers that may have never done an RSI before, that you've never met before, because it's a flash team. And actually, if you didn't use a checklist, might actually throw a spanner in the works. They may have said, yep, I've cannulated the arm, and actually the cannula is blown. It's actually it's not in the vein. So therefore the drugs you've just given your RSI drugs, they've not gone systemically at all. You've now given intramuscular drugs essentially, or subcutaneous drugs. And what are you going to do? You know, and of course, most well-practiced systems have got two lines. So if one line goes, another line's there. Again, it's this 2 is 1, 1 is none principle. But again, that's a checklist. That's a functionality of a checklist. And what you can't do is necessarily quality. You certainly can't quality assure the experience of the wider team you've never met. And actually, you do need these predefined rules that you prescribe to play by, we're all in flash teams on a daily basis. Even in the emergency department, you're in a flash team. You may have a semblance of colleagues that you work with, and indeed nurses or nursing staff that you work with, but they'll change on a daily basis. And so you cannot quality assure other people's experience. Therefore, we have to come back to a common denominator.
Yeah, I mean, they did. I remember a quote, I think it was from one of the consultants at London's Air Ambulance, was about not planning for the best doctor and the best paramedic on the best day, but planning for the worst doctor they've ever had, the worst paramedic they've ever had, on the worst, you know, in the worst environment. I do seem to remember him pointedly looking at me when he said the worst doctor, but, you know, that was possibly me being paranoid. I think it does go back to that sort of underlying issue with human factors, which is part of this sort of the institutions that we have been educated in, and that we generally think the world works by, has, I think historically was better at understanding this than it is now. It's like we're now in a post-industrial age whereby we're so much more rational, and I'm so much more professional. And so by creating these trips, these circuit breakers, as you call them, are seen as extraneous, these fanciful things. But actually, underneath it all, I just do wonder whether people are just sort of slightly threatened by them, even if they don't realize that's what they feel is the problem. I do think, however, there is some genuinely, you know, reasonable objections to them, because they have been used potentially in the wrong way. I've done a lot of talks about this kind of stuff to people, and as soon as you utter the words aviation, people will sort of roll their eyes and groan, because they know what's coming. They know that there's this vogue about talking about safety in healthcare, and just basically saying we can learn everything that we, you know, that we need to know from pilots. And I think that what we have to be more open to is that there is a lot to learn from other institutions, other professions. I agree with some people. I don't think that everything that aviation does in terms of their safety procedures is the same as what we do, because actually they are different. The risks are different. The interplay of humans is different. There's that old joke about an anaesthetist, you know, would never take off in the horrendous plane they're being asked to take off in, if you took that analogy to be the elderly patient they were doing a fractured neck of femur and anaesthetic on. But I do think we have loads of opportunities to learn about how we interact as human beings and how we perform as human beings from other professions and other walks of life in medicine. And we've considered ourselves a little bit of a bubble for too long, I think, because there's so many good corollaries in terms of the workplace. You know, I said I read a book not that long ago about a restaurateur and his experiences in working in sort of these high intensity restaurants, and the similarities between the shop floor and the emergency department was just unbelievable, and I never would have thought to look there. Do you know what I mean? And so I think that's where, you know, we have to recognize that medicine in many ways is incredibly special, but in others it really isn't.
So, Matt, as we come into land, just a few more questions. One is around, you made this really interesting comment earlier around this unspoken contract of truth. You know, there's truth and trust. You know, there's truth in what you're saying, that I trust what you're saying, and there's trust in the team from a patient perspective, but also as a colleague. And actually, one of the things which you and I can attest to is the fact that although you're the unwritten contract is that truth, you seek truth and you want to embody truth, and as do I. So this is one in one. This is one in 10,000 adrenaline. This is what I'm going to give the patient. The mitigating the evolution of human factors is that actually, just because you speak, you believe this to be true, doesn't mean it is true. Let me cross-check it with you to make sure it is the truth. And then you can give it to the patient. So that actually, although we're coming together with this unwritten contract of truth and trust, that actually we're cross-checking truth and we're cross-checking trust, just to make sure that both are quality assured. Now, again, this speaks to something you were saying earlier, Matt, about this speaks to the heart of ego. Actually, how dare you challenge my trust and how dare you challenge my truth? Now, and again, it's a culture. It's a cultural perspective, and it takes time to change. And we have seen it in our lifetime change. Whereas I can speak into your practice, you can speak into mine as a paramedic and doctor. Now, that never used to happen. Hierarchies are steep, and the classic case, to your point again, around aviation and some of the fundamental lessons is around flattening the hierarchy and the gradient, so that we're allowing people to speak into each other's practice. Because 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 adrenaline, very different strengths, same drug, very different strengths, very different outcome. But actually, testing each other's truth and testing each other's trust in an open fashion hopefully leads to more safe practice. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you've touched on a lot of interesting stuff, but I think at the core of it is that human factors are universal because we're human. And so and this is also, I think, a bit of a warning surrounding human factors about hierarchy, because actually having, now sort of operating at a sort of relatively senior level, there comes times in crises and when you need the team to work, and there does need to be leadership and followership. And where do you call that a hierarchy in a pejorative way, in that you have some people who are better than others or whatever, then that's clearly not what that means. But there is a difference in responsibility, and there is a difference in the experience of some people and how they need the team to operate. However, everyone within that team is human, including the leader, and so the human factors elements are just as applicable to them as they are to any of the team members within that. And I think that's what we need to make a distinction about, is that in the team, everyone doesn't have the same role, and that is really important. Not everyone has the same responsibility, and that is really important, but everyone still is very human and has the same ability to make assumptions and not hear and to forget stuff and have their bandwidth saturated and all those other kind of things that are part of the human factors teaching. And similarly speaking, the person who's in charge, it must recognize within the team they are working with, that each person there is saturated. Their bandwidth is saturated by the task they're task focused on, and that you can't overload them with X, Y, Z. So it goes two ways. And so, if you are operating in a hierarchy that says, just because I'm in charge, I can't be questioned, then you're absolutely right. That is that is just really, yeah, I mean, it speaks against the evidence as well, apart from anything else. And we've got sort of a million examples of how that's not the case. And a system that operates in fear of hierarchy is going to make and deference is going to make massive errors, whether that be the examples of things like I said, I've spoken about Chernobyl, but there's South Korean Airlines and a myriad of different examples within medicine, I'm sure. But the inability for people to be able to speak out and to see the other person who is their leader as human as they are is part of that problem. But there still needs to be that acknowledgement that there are different roles and there are different responsibilities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's key to both acknowledge that, but then, like you said, meet in the middle and allow people to speak into each other's practice, which is as you said, absolutely central. So just as we come into land on the conversation, Matt, and we reflected on a lot of different concepts within the conversation, could you speak to this common denominator which we all struggle with? And indeed, no clinician gets a free ticket with this one, around fatigue and sort of fatigue management within practice, and maybe indeed how you deal with fatigue, because it is a common denominator. It can have a massive effect and impact on practice, and indeed whether you like it or not, you have to deal with it.
Yeah. I think that I've dealt with quite a lot of fatigue, but I'm sure other professionals have had huge challenges in terms of huge hours and huge physical demands and being undernourished and all these other kind of things that might go along with their clinical practice in all sorts of walks of life all over the world and stuff, and so they're probably far better at sort of talking about this stuff than I am. However, I think that again, because we know that the ability for you to be able to concentrate and analyze data and being able to problem solve and all those other kind of things are a reduced on the basis of your brain's ability to be able to use glucose and your sleep deprivation and all these other kind of things, it is important to be well rested. We talk about this I'm the lead for our induction program, and we talk about how important it is to be rested from a patient safety perspective, because there's a really interesting book which I'd recommend everyone who's interested in this stuff to read, which is called On Combat, which talks a lot about the physiology of high stress sort of environments, mostly military and the police and that kind of stuff. But it does talk a little bit about healthcare and these facts, and I think that people don't often understand how exhausting decision fatigue becomes. You can be tired anyway, and how important it is to have accessible accessible glucose and accessible sleep and rest, etc., to be able to make these decisions based on analysis rather than based on heuristics. These and to be overly influenced by emotion and these, because if what we're hoping for is a rational analysis of data, almost to what is it, after all this stuff talking about human factors, what we're trying to aim for is to eliminate as much of them as possible in the way that we're decision making, we're making decisions. It means that actually we can have more useful human interactions with our patients and with our colleagues when we're not at the behest of our sort of lesser demons, as it were. And I think that ensuring that you recognize how your performance changes with fatigue is, I've been one of these unfortunate medics who have come close to falling asleep at the wheel, and I'm sure lots of people have, and you don't really recognize it's going to happen to you. But I think as long as we in our systems acknowledge that fatigue is a performance issue, and it's and that we are trying our best to create workspaces where people can rest, and we're looking at having places that people can and the rotors that allow people to get the best physiological rest they can do to be able to deliver care in the middle of the night for prolonged periods of time, because that's what we're asking of people. It means that they will be able to perform better because their cognitive abilities will be better. However, I think that in the background to that if you create a system, a bit like what I was saying about the worst doctor and the worst paramedic and the worst environment, you create a system that means that the thing you fall back on when your cognitive systems are not working 100% is actually pretty safe. So it's the thing that whether you be sort of relatively terrified, so you're falling back on your base training. So this is another quote from that book on combat I told you about, which is basically saying that, you know, when in stressful situations, you don't rise to the challenge, you fall to the level of your training. And I think that's such an important concept to understand. And that comes very much into how we perform, you know, when we're tired. And I can speak to this just from this morning. So like I led the handover in our pediatric emergency department, and I was leading one of our juniors through the handover process. And we reflected just a little bit about the handovers, and I was just saying to them, you know, there were some patients who were handed over to you who haven't had decisions made on them, and the question I raised to him was, are you just gonna go ahead with those plans without seeing the patient? And he's like, yeah. I was like, I mean, you can. I mean, you know, you, but, you know, it's, and I said it's based on trust. But at the same time, a bit like that checklist, you know, how much do you trust the judgment of someone who made that call in 20 minutes, seeing that kid at 7:20 in the morning, having worked all night shift? Like, you know, we have to acknowledge the, and I think part of the battle is acknowledging that what our performance is like when fatigued, rather than necessarily saying there's a huge amount. We can't mitigate the risk entirely. We just can't, because we work in challenging environments for long hours, long rotors, and out of hours, and we all know all those things impair performance. And so we need to put in things that mitigate for human factors in those environments, because we know they're bound to happen. And certainly that, you know, when we've got systems that don't accept, that don't, you know, that look at the error that a clinician makes and sees it in the isolation of a single decision made in the middle of, you know, in the middle of the day, in the cold light of day, and don't see it in the context of a person who's already done 12 hours, has seen the patient in, you know, at the end of their shift, whilst the department is complete, you know, is so busy. We must be looking at fatigue in those decision making and sort of trying to mitigate for it.
Listen, that's a fantastic place to finish off, Matt. And I wholeheartedly agree with that around questioning practice at certain times of day, not just questioning, but cross-checking and starting to look at ways in which we can, like you said, quality assure decision making when we are more vulnerable, you know, in hour 10, 11, 12, or 13, 14, when it can be more difficult to orchestrate sensible decisions, long term, short term memory patterns as well. So I think there's the first step to that is acknowledgement, as you said this morning in your handover, the acknowledgement that actually it might be prudent and worthwhile to check decisions in those last hours of decision making. Matt, listen, that's a fantastic place to finish off. Thank you for the last hour. I'm mindful we've gone slightly over time, but thank you. It's been hugely valuable just getting your thoughts and reflections. And indeed, we'll put a few in the show notes, a few of the concepts which we spoke about in the episode. But thanks once again, Matt.
Not a problem. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.